Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today, the focus is on the Secret Service. Based on a recent article written by 9/11 researcher Kevin Ryan called Secret Service Failures on 9/11, A Call for Transparency. Since the Secret Service has been in the news of late in an unflattering light, I thought it was a good time to do a show on this topic related to 9/11. So first, here's some background information on the Secret Service. This comes from their website, secretservice.gov. And under the section called Who We Are, it says, the United States Secret Service is a federal law enforcement agency with headquarters in Washington, D.C., and more than 150 offices throughout the United States and abroad. And then it goes on to say, under the section, What is the Origin of the Secret Service? The United States Secret Service, one of the nation's oldest federal investigative law enforcement agencies, was founded in 1865 as a branch of the U.S. Treasury Department. It was originally created to combat the counterfeiting of U.S. currency, a serious problem at the time. In fact, following the Civil War, it was estimated that one-third to one-half of the currency in circulation was counterfeit. In 1901, following the assassination of President William McKinley in Buffalo, New York, the Secret Service was first tasked with its second mission, the protection of the president. Today, the Secret Service's mission is twofold, protection of the president, vice president, and others, and investigations into crimes against the financial infrastructure of the United States. And then it goes on to say, under what types of crimes does the Secret Service investigate? It says, the Secret Service has primary jurisdiction to investigate threats against Secret Service protectees, as well as financial crimes, which include counterfeiting of U.S. currency or other U.S. government obligations, forgery or theft of U.S. Treasury checks, bonds or other securities, credit card fraud, telecommunications fraud, computer fraud, identity fraud, and certain other crimes affecting federally insured financial institutions. And now you're going to hear a recent interview between James Corbett of The Corbett Report and Kevin Ryan discussing his recent article on the Secret Service failures on 9/11. And using the word failure may be way too generous a term here. So let's begin.
Kevin Ryan is the co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies and a founding member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. In 2004, he was fired from his position at Underwriters Laboratories for publicly questioning that company's role in the much-criticized NIST report into the destruction of the World Trade Center. In his latest investigation, Ryan turns his attention to the Secret Service's actions on 9/11 and what these actions might tell us about government foreknowledge of the attacks.
Yeah, there are several parts to that article. The first one asks the question whether the Secret Service was aware in some ways of the events of 9/11. And the reason that that question is asked is that the President of the United States was very well protected in many ways, except from the very obvious danger of terrorists from hijacked airliners. So we had snipers on the roof of the building. It was well planned. People were in the hallways. The police and the Secret Service were all over the place. And yet, the president was allowed to enter this building when, at 9:03 in the morning on September 11th, everyone else in the country was watching the second plane hit the World Trade Center. And frankly, most people in government were aware of multiple hijackings at that time. They were aware that these planes were being crashed in the buildings, at least one of them. And so the question becomes, why did the president enter the building? Why was he allowed to enter the building and put all those people at risk, as well as himself? And why did the Secret Service allow that? And then just minutes after he entered the building and entered the classroom, the report of the second crash into the World Trade Center was made. And he was told And everyone knew, including everyone in the United States at that time, including myself, we knew that the country was under a series of coordinated terrorist attacks. And yet the president stayed in that classroom for quite some time, and he actually stayed in the building itself for another 30 minutes or more, even giving a national presentation on television, essentially announcing to the world that he's still there in that building, which part of the difficulty there is that this photo opportunity of the president in this classroom, which was to support his education policy, was announced 4 days before that. And visitors to this event were brought in 2 days before, given thorough instruction. Everyone knew that he was there in Sarasota at this Booker Elementary. And yet he stayed there for 30 minutes after the second crash into the World Trade Center. This indicates foreknowledge on the part of the Secret Service, at least, if not others, that this building and the president was not a target on 9/11. Some of the other points made in the article have to do with the protection of the vice president and how quickly he was removed from his location, which was his office in the White House. And there's some contradictory accounts. Most of them put Vice President Cheney being removed by the Secret Service just after 9 o'clock, at the time that everybody was learning that the second plane had impacted the World Trade Center, and also at the time that the FAA, and we believe also the Secret Service, was aware that two other planes were hijacked and were both headed toward Washington. This article goes into evaluation of some FOIA release documents that were received by 9/11 researcher Aidan Monahan. I've done quite a bit of FOIA requests myself, but Aidan has done some spectacular work and really been persistent in the terms of following up. For example, on this request, he did ask for these documents, Secret Service knowledge, timelines, and was essentially refused. He was told, well, we can't find those documents. And then he asked again, and then they could find the documents. And they did release a number of kind of random documents. Unfortunately, not everything that really is important. I went into, in this article, interviews by two really critical people, one of them being Edward Marenzel, who was responsible for the president's activities in Sarasota, and also his boss, Carl Truscott, who was the special agent in charge of the Presidential Protective Division. And Carl Truscott was in the White House. He was taking precautionary measures at a quarter after nine, and yet the 9/11 Commission report says that Vice President Cheney was not removed from his office until 9:36, quite a bit later than that, and well over 30 minutes later than most of the witnesses say. We have a White House photographer, we have the president's secretary, we have Richard Clark, all of these people saying that Vice President Cheney was removed from his office just after 9 o'clock. Why this is important, it's important to realize that there's one very critical testimony that puts Vice President Cheney in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, the PEOC, at about 9:20 in the morning. And the reason that's important is that there is this testimony from Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta tells the story of how a young man would come in and give the vice president updates about one of the planes coming into Washington. And Mineta actually specifies that this is the plane, Flight 77, headed for the Pentagon. And he gives him reports at 50 miles out and at 30 miles out and at 10 miles out. Now, if Vice President Cheney didn't arrive in the PEOC until 9:38 or after, then he would not have been able to get those reports, according to Mineta. But all these other accounts say that he was whisked out of his office. He would have been there. And the Secret Service documents that have been released also indicate that Vice President Cheney would have been there in the PEOC prior to 9:30 a.m. That's validating the important testimony of Norman Mineta.
And I think in addition to the timeline of the Secret Service response to Cheney, of course, it's also important to take into account the nature of the actions they took in protecting him. And by his own admission, within minutes, well, again, the timeline we can't be sure of, but certainly quite within short order, Secret Service agents were literally hoisting him by his belt, his feet almost not touching the ground as they escorted him to the PEOC. So absolutely, the discrepancy between what happened with Cheney and what happened with Bush, I think, is telling in and of itself.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's other little things having to do with, for example, Mrs. Cheney, who, according to the Secret Service documents, was in the White House shelter area, kind of an interim area, almost a hallway, I think, on the way to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, when Carl Truscott, the Secret Service agent in charge, came to get him, Mr. Cheney. Mrs. Cheney was there before 9:30 in the morning. Yet the official count says that Mrs. Cheney didn't even arrive at the White House till almost 10 o'clock in the morning. So there seems to be some very serious discrepancies in these various timelines. This article on the Secret Service also goes into an important question about why the military did not respond to an original request. That is, why the Secret Service, did not respond to an original request from Andrews Air Force Base to provide help. So, for example, Major Daniel Kane was a supervisor of flying at Andrews Air Force Base, and shortly after 9 o'clock again, he called his Secret Service contact. His name was Kenneth Beauchamp. And he said, "We're available to help. You guys need any help? We've got jets available," essentially. And Beauchamp told him, "No, we don't need any help. This is just after 9 o'clock. A second plane had already crashed in the World Trade Center. And apparently, the Secret Service was aware of these other two planes coming in. But Kenneth Beauchamp, at least, was telling Major Kane that Secret Service did not need help from Andrews Air Force Base." But Beauchamp did say he'd call back. So hang on, I'll call back. 30 minutes later, he never called back. In fact, he never called back at all. But 30 minutes later, someone else from the Secret Service called. This was right before Flight 77 was reported to impact the Pentagon. And that's when they were finally saying, "Get us some jets, some interceptor jets from Andrews." Well, that's curious in itself. That's 30 minutes difference almost between when the original offer was made by Major Kane and when he was taken up by that, by the Secret Service. The more glaring discrepancy is that jets didn't actually launch from Andrews for more than an hour after that. So 90 minutes after Major Kane originally offered help. And the reason for that is there's a lot of discussion about this General Worley who showed up. He was the supervisor, wasn't there originally. He was actually the commander of Andrews Air Force Base. And he showed up right around the time Flight 77 was impacting the Pentagon. And the official story says he was very confused about who had the authority to order jets to launch. And he wouldn't take the information from the Secret Service. It's all very confusing. General Worley's no longer with us. He died in a very unusual train accident in Washington. But it is really important for us to see that Andrews Air Force Base was only 10 miles away from the Pentagon. And it didn't launch jets until 10:38 in the morning, over an hour after the Pentagon was hit. These weren't even armed jets. So if you're going to launch non-armed jets, at least you could do it around the time these buildings are being hit. But there is no explanation for why that was not done.
Well, let's drill down into this a little further. So obviously the actions or inactions of the Secret Service detail of Bush on that day are extremely puzzling at the very least, and due to the call for transparency on those actions, I think, is a well-placed one. But in terms of protocol or procedures that should be followed in these situations, do we have any idea of what is actually written down or if there's anything that we know that the Secret Service should have been doing in this situation?
Well, the only thing I referred to was a book that was written by an expert on the Secret Service who was also just really confused by why, for example, in the elementary school, the Secret Service didn't immediately move the president to a secure location. That's really the Presidential Protective Division, the PPD of the Secret Service, that's their entire job. And my understanding from, I can't name the exact references right now, but my understanding is that they don't really even require the authority to be given to them. It's their authority. If the president or the vice president or other people they're in charge of are in danger, they are to immediately move those people to a secure location. It would be nice to be able to reference, and I think that's a good follow-up action, the actual law that says this or the actual procedure in Secret Service documentation. I'll try to find that, but my understanding is that from experts who have studied it, this is just immediate. It's not even something that they would ask the president about. It's their job to do that, to protect the president.
Well, okay, so let's draw out the implications of this, because, again, the point of the article, obviously, calling for greater transparency regarding the documentation of what was happening, the timeline, things like that. But really, what this amounts to is the fact that information is being withheld that would help us to determine what was really happening and how the Secret Service was responding and why they responded the way they did. And really, again, with so many of these things, when we start studying them regarding 9/11 in particular, the cover-up after the fact either indicates some sort of monumental failure, as indicated in your title, or perhaps the possibility always there of deliberate actions to confuse or obfuscate the response to that day. And of course, that's not really decidable from the information that they don't allow to leak out, so that's obviously part of why the call for transparency is important. But playing the devil's advocate role, people would inevitably say, well, the Secret Service consists of all sorts of different agents, these are trained professionals, they've worked their whole lives. Can we seriously be expected to believe that all of this Secret Service detail was in on some sort of plot and none of them have spilled the beans, et cetera, et cetera? How would you respond to that type of criticism?
Well, I think that there may be reason for us to see that not everyone at the elementary school was necessarily aware of everything that was going on. I mean, those of us who saw on television planes crashing into the World Trade Center, we were also hearing stories about more planes being hijacked than actually were. I was hearing stories about planes crashing in the National Mall. But as far as the Secret Service itself, they are almost like any other government agency that is compartmentalized. It's a top-down sort of an operation. So, you know, whoever is in charge of the detail, they would need to be making a decision or at least allowing others to make a decision. But all of the agents who are there, they wouldn't necessarily have the authority to override. So they wouldn't necessarily have to be in on it, as we say. But I named a couple of people. Edward Marenzel, who was the supervisor of the detail that the president was being monitored by. And then his boss, Carl Truscott. I believe those two fellows knew that procedures needed to be followed and were not being followed. Whether or not they knew why, we can't say why they didn't follow procedure, why they didn't override others who may have been telling them to not move the president. But some of the reasons given in the 9/11 Commission report are just really weak. For example, there's two major reasons for why the president wasn't moved. One of them, the Commission report says, well, Bush himself decided that he wanted to project calm. So he's going to sit there in the classroom, reading the book, projecting calm. Now, remember, all of us in the United States, at least, were either listening to the radio or watching the television by this time. We were not calm. And I would think that most would agree that we would expect the president to take charge at that time, not sit and read a book and project calm. So that's a kind of a weak reason. And then the second reason was that the Secret Service, their determination was that, yes, it was an important and urgent time, but they didn't feel the need to immediately rush the president out of the room. So it's not a very strong, I can't remember the exact wording, something like that. They didn't feel the need to whisk him away right away, which is contradictory to some of the stories about the vice president. As you mentioned, he was pulled up by his arms and just dragged out of his office. Wherever the timeline fell out, that was the story. He was picked up and dragged out. They didn't ask him. They didn't worry about whether or not he was projecting calm or whether or not it was a good thing to see. They moved him, and you would have thought that's what they would have done with the president as well. But, you know, there's more than just the movement of the president or the vice president. On this issue, there's also the question of whether or not air cover was appropriately requested for Bush's motorcade as it moved away to the airport. And then for Air Force One, as it flew around the country, apparently in a random fashion, first to Louisiana, then to Nebraska, then finally back to Washington, the Secret Service should have immediately requested air cover for the motorcade, which for some reason drove in the wrong direction, for one thing. I'm not really sure what to say about that. They had to turn the entire motorcade around because it was moving in the opposite direction of the airport and then head back to the airport. But there was no air cover for him. And again, this was well-publicized photo opportunity. There was evidence that there might have been an attempt on the president's life earlier that morning by some pseudo-journalists. And so you would think that there would have been more concern about hijacked airliners, if nothing else. And then the Air Force One situation was attempted to be explained by the 9/11 Commission report. But basically, the president moved to Barksdale because, again, Edward Mirenzel, whose interview is not available to us, hasn't been released, upon which a lot of the 9/11 Commission answers are based, decided that Washington was too unstable for the president. So he flew to Barksdale in Louisiana. He stopped there and he gave a presentation again in Barksdale. He flew from there to Offutt in Nebraska. And then finally he got air cover on the way back from Nebraska to Washington. But that was several hours later, and leads again to the question of how anyone could have failed to see that with all these hijacked airliners and the importance of the president as an icon, if nothing else, that he wasn't protected by air cover.
All very, very interesting points, and there are so many different ways to explore them. And of course, I would suggest people go and take a look at your article. But ultimately, what would you like to come of this article? It's called A Call for Transparency. What kind of transparency are you looking for here?
That's an interesting question. I'll let you in on a response I got to this article. I'm in periodic communication with one of the 9/11 Commission staff members. His name is Miles Karas, actually one of the more important investigators of the 9/11 Commission and authors of the 9/11 Commission report. And I didn't send him this particular article, but he did find it. He found it fairly rapidly. And atypical of his response, he came across as somewhat angry about it. And I'm not trying to tell tales on him here, but he believed that for example, Mineta was totally mistaken. He couldn't say why, but Mineta's just simply totally mistaken. And he got a little bit defensive about his own research, but the main point he tried to make to me was that his report was based on primary evidence. And I said, that's exactly right. That's the title of the article, A Call for Transparency. Researchers like myself and Aiden, we have to have all these FOIA requests to get documents that Miles and his staff just had provided to him, interviews just available to him. And if we had all of that information, that's what I think, if anything, this article would ideally do. It would drive the release of Edward Marenzel's interview transcript, of Carl Truscott's interview transcript, of the primary evidence upon which the 9/11 Commission report based their findings and answered all of these questions.
You just heard a recent interview between James Corbett of the Corbett Report and 9/11 researcher Kevin Ryan. And speaking of the Secret Service, I was looking through James Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable, because I remembered reading something about the Secret Service involvement in the JFK assassination. In 1961, Kennedy hired Abe Bolden, the first African-American, to work in the White House detail of the Secret Service. Here's what James Douglas says about this in his book, JFK and the Unspeakable. And I quote, "Abraham Bolden saw increasing evidence of the president's isolation and danger from the standpoint of security. Most of the Secret Service agents seemed to hate John Kennedy. They joked among themselves that if someone shot at him, they'd get out of the way. The agent's drunken after-hours behavior carried over into lax security for the president. Bolden refused to drink or play cards with them. The other agents made remarks about niggers in his presence. As he had before in his life, Abraham Bolden spoke up. He complained to his superiors about the president's poor security. They did nothing. After 40 days as a member of the White House detail, Bolden refused to take part any longer in a charade. He returned voluntarily to the Chicago office. He had demoted himself on principle from the highest position an African-American had ever held in the Secret Service. And on the day of JFK's assassination, author James Douglas goes on to say, quote, "The assassins of the president controlled the crime scene, Dealey Plaza, from the beginning. When witnesses instinctively stormed the grassy knoll to chase a shooter who was apparently behind the fence at the top, they immediately encountered plainclothesmen identifying themselves as Secret Service agents. These men facilitated and covered up the escape of the triggermen, if they were not themselves the triggermen, shielded by Secret Service credentials." Also from James Douglas's book are the following. "The Warren Commission went out of its way to ignore the obvious evidence of Secret Service imposters at the source of the shots. As we learned from Secret Service agent Abraham Bolden, the Secret Service took the extraordinary step of withdrawing and replacing all of its agents' commission books a month and a half following the assassination, moving Bolden to suspect that Secret Service identification had been used as a cover by the assassins of President Kennedy." As the House Select Committee on Assassinations put it, it was the Secret Service that defined and supervised the functions of the police during Kennedy's visit to Dallas. The Secret Service also made a critical change in the protection the president would normally receive from his motorcycle escorts. Following past precedents, the Dallas police had made plans at a preliminary meeting, not attended by the Secret Service, to assign motorcycle escorts alongside the president's car, thereby partially screening the president from any gunfire. However, at a Dallas Police Department Secret Service coordinating meeting held on November 21st, the Secret Service changed the plan. The motorcycle escorts were pulled back from their position alongside the limousine, where they shielded the president, to positions in the rear, where they were not a hindrance to snipers. Even more critically, the Secret Service withdrew the protection of its agents normally stationed on the back of the presidential limousine. If the agents had been in their usual posts on the limousine, holding the handrails on the car, they could have obstructed fire or thrown themselves on the president when the shooting began. But they, too, had been withdrawn in Dallas. They were reassigned to the car following the limousine, where they were useless in preventing the assassination. During the shooting of the president, the special agent in charge of the follow-up car, Emery Roberts, actually ordered his agents not to move even after recognizing the first shot as a shot. Now, I want to say that I'm sure that most of the people who work for the Secret Service are honest and good people serving their country. But there is clearly enough evidence that some Secret Service agents do not fit that description. And now I'm very excited to share with you that the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, architect Richard Gage, will be making a 20-city tour across the U.S. to promote the release of their new movie, Experts Speak Out. And one of the stops will be here in Connecticut in the Hartford area. The dates aren't finalized yet, but I do know that the stop will be sometime between June 15th and 19th. So stay tuned for more on this exciting event. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.